Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Professor Cheung, for the invitation. So today I'm going to talk about Inter-Asia's role in the China-India relationship in the Qing period, which actually is a somewhat misleading title, as you see. It's much too broad. I'm going to be talking about one specific part of it. And I think, generally speaking, if we think about the China-India relationship in the Qing period, and were to say what is the new or distinctive element in China-India relations in the Qing period, most people would say, quite rightly, that one, of course, is the expansion of trade between China and India, becoming one of the great trading relationships in the world in that period. Another one would be, of course, the imperial expansion of the Qing Empire to the Himalayas through Tibet, followed shortly thereafter by the expansion of British India into the Himalayas, which sets the stage for China and India to have their modern land border through the Himalayas, of course, much contested. But today I'm not going to talk about so much the political dimension of things as another topic that's maybe largely uninfluenced by political shifts, and that is the somewhat mysterious question of the continued travel of Indian mendicants into the Qing Empire, specifically into China and Mongolia, and look at some cases that we have documented of this phenomena and try to put it into something of a larger context. Not many people have paid attention to the continued travel of Indian mendicants into the Qing Empire, and so there isn't a great deal of scholarship on the question, especially with regard to China and Mongolia, but I'll try to outline a few questions that I'll at least touch on in my talk today. So one is, who are these people? Why are they going into the Qing Empire? What's motivating them to travel all the way to China and Mongolia in some cases? Of course, there's the question of how were they understood by Chinese Mongolian Manchu observers once they got into the Qing Empire. There's the question of whether we should see them as traders, sort of small-scale peddlers in high-value objects, or are they coming for another purpose into the Qing Empire. There's the question of how did they travel, and there's the question of what is the larger political context in which they're moving, what factors are driving them and maybe preventing them later on from entering the Qing Empire. So let me just talk a little bit by way of context about who these people seem to have been. There's an extensive literature on the presence of people termed Gosains in India and in Tibet. And most of this literature notes that they had a significant economic role in addition to their religious activities and pilgrimages, going back to a pioneering article by Bernard Cohn in the early 1960s. One aspect of their relationship that many scholars have talked about in the past is that they frequented the Himalayas, and many of them entered Tibet. The presence of these Indian Gosains going into Tibet in the 17th and 18th century is well documented. One observer, George Bogle, says that the Panchen Lama in the 1770s had a retinue that included 150 of these Hindu Gosains in his headquarters. Later on, Samuel Turner claims that there were 300, quote, Hindus, Gosains, and Sannyasis, end quote, in the retinue of his successor as Panchen Lama in the 1780s. And so there's no question that quite a large number of Hindu mendicants are going into Tibet, some for pilgrimage, some for trade, and some probably to get the patronage that the Panchen Lamas were offering to these men at this time. Especially European observers have had a hard time characterizing who exactly these Gosains were. William Kirkpatrick, who was a British officer in the 1790s, traveling in this area, described them as, quote, at once devotees, beggars, soldiers, and merchants, and all aspects of this activity have been documented by historians. Generally speaking, with regard to the Qing Empire, these men often don't come across as individuals. Really, the only individual figure among the Gosains who has attracted an extensive degree of historical interest is one man, Purungir, who becomes an important diplomatic intermediary between the Qing Empire and British India, going back to the 1770s, and his career in that capacity continues in the 1780s. And he's sort of behind the scenes even in the early 1790s before he leaves the stage. So we know quite a bit about his diplomatic career. We also know that he had some degree of religious or pilgrimage interest in going into Tibet, and that he also had some sort of commercial interests, which are somewhat less well known. But generally speaking, we only know about him as a traveler into Tibet, even though he claims to have traveled as far as Beijing. I think reliably we know a lot less about Gosains and others who are going from India into China in this period. So I'll just sort of set a little bit of background context before I launch into the individual cases, which are much more interesting, I think, than the context in some ways. If you were in Lhasa in this period in the 17th and 18th century and you wanted to continue onward into China or Mongolia, basically you would have two routes that you could follow. You could either continue going towards the east and enter through the Kham region of eastern Tibet into Sichuan province. Once you got into Sichuan province, you could travel within China, or you could continue sort of northwest, go through Amdo, Qinghai, come out in Gansu province, and then you could continue onward into Mongolia, or potentially go further to the east into northern China. And there's quite a bit of evidence, as we'll see, that the Gosains that I'll be talking about, the mendicants, are traveling both routes. I think one sort of unanswered question we have is, if you wanted to travel overland from India into China in this period on foot, it's one thing to say that you can go along a certain route, which is true, but how do you support yourself? How do you move around? Certainly, you would think that Indian mendicant travelers in China and Mongolia would be quite conspicuous in this period, but largely, these men seem to have eluded the official eye of surveillance. And I think that's an interesting question behind all of this. How and why were these men able to travel as widely as they did without necessarily coming to the attention of the state? A few of them get arrested, but we have a lot of evidence that others did not necessarily get arrested in their travels. And I think one interesting case that I'll start out with concerns not an Indian mendicant, but a Dutchman, sort of underknown figure, I think, considering his exploits, a man named Samuel van de Put, who was a sort of private traveler going around Asia in this period. And in the 1720s, he left India, he went into Tibet, and continued across the Qing Empire and made his way ultimately to Dolondor, which is hundreds of miles north of Beijing. And his sort of letter that he sends to the French Jesuit Antoine Gobile in 1734 from this place tells us that he was able to travel this far, at least through China, by being sort of patronized by Tibetan Buddhist lamas who took him, for whatever reason, under their wing, brought him to Beijing, and then conducted him north to this Tibetan Buddhist temple in Dolonor. And so I think this gives us a hint or a clue that if you were an Indian mendicant wishing to travel in China or Mongolia, you're sort of most conducive environment would be the clerical world of either Chinese Buddhist temples or the Tibetan Buddhist temple world. And as we'll see, most evidence suggests that, in fact, this is exactly what these men were doing, traveling through these monastic networks from temple to temple. A few other points by way of a preamble before I go into the individual cases. One commonality that I'll talk about a bit more, especially in Chinese records about these men, is the recurrence of certain terms by which we can detect them, one of which is simply to describe them as sung, as Buddhist priests, and that I think is an important clue from the Chinese point of view as to how they were being interpreted and understood. Probably very few of these men were Buddhist, maybe none of them were Buddhist, but to a Chinese audience offering patronage, they were certainly interpreted as holy men, probably in some sense Buddhists. Another term that's used specifically to describe these men is the term arhat, a sort of lower level accomplished Buddhist practitioner who hasn't reached bodhisattvahood, but is nonetheless an accomplished Buddhist practitioner, in Chinese lohan. And I think this is also maybe a clue to how these men were understood, because there's a long artistic tradition in Chinese and Tibetan painting and statuary in Buddhist temples that often figures who have complete conspicuously even stylized quote-unquote Indian characteristics were these Arhat statues and paintings. So I think this is one lens through which their Chinese audience understood them, this artistic tradition, and maybe one of the reasons that these accounts are so consistent in using the term Arhat to refer to these individuals. And finally, an interesting clue that recurs in many of these cases is that the homeland that these men are seen as coming from is the place known as Da Shitian, Great Western Heaven. This is a term for India, certainly, but a term for India that's really only found within the context of the sort of Indian mendicant traveler. You rarely encounter this term for India, Da Shitian, outside of the context of these Indian mendicant travelers. And that, I think, is another interesting question that we can ask ourselves and try to address. So without further ado, I'll sort of introduce a few of these cases, and we can look at the features of our records that sort of stand out from these cases. And I'll begin with the earliest that I found, an encounter that dates from 1613, Yuan Zhongdao traveling through China, keeping a diary of his travels. And when he's in Huguang province in the late Ming, he says, "I reached this temple and I met a man from Great Shitian. He could speak Chinese." And this is, again, another very interesting recurrent feature of many of these accounts, is that the Indian mendicants identified to a greater or lesser extent are described as being able to speak Chinese in most cases. In one case, the person says, "He could speak Chinese. I couldn't understand him very well because his Chinese was not very good." But in most cases, people are very impressed by the level of Chinese attained by these mendicant travelers. And so he says, he had come from his home country to China. His journey had taken 8 years. He had once gone to Beijing and emerged from meditation. I think that's what's meant by this term. Chuguan, although I could be corrected on that point. And he's given this sort of embroidered cassock by the Empress Dowager at Sisheng, the mother of the emperor at that time, the Wanli emperor. And so here we have a number of themes: a long journey, able to speak Chinese, described as a monk, and getting some kind of patronage, both from presumably the temple he's staying in, but also from the Empress Dowager. And this is, again, something that we see in a few other cases, that these men are being patronized by one or more high-ranking officials. There's another very interesting early account. Here we don't see the keywords Great Shitian or Arhat, but a man named Chen Ding, who's famous for giving a description of Southwest China in the late 17th, early 18th century, discusses going to Buddhist monasteries on Jizu Mountain in Yunnan province. And he says, "Many of these monks that I saw there have curling hair, hook noses, deep-set eyes, and pierced ears. These are the Arhats seen in the past begging food in Wutaishan, Beijing, and in Jiangsu, Zhejiang, Fujian, and Guangdong. They are very well-versed in Chinese." So again, when he encounters these men in Yunnan, they're sort of familiar to him as a type. He's not shocked, necessarily, to see them there. The third case that I think is especially interesting, pardon the small print here, but this is a high official named Zhang Pengge. He's sent on a mission that's supposed to go negotiate with the Russians. It's an abortive mission because of unrest in Mongolia. He's forced to turn around, but nonetheless, while traveling through Mongolia, he encounters a group of people, and he says, "We encountered several Fan," which could mean Tibetan or foreign. Here I think it probably means foreign monks. "Their visages resembled Arhats. Their bodies and bones were flexible. They could put their feet on their heads and put their heads through their armpits, and they sat cross-legged like Arhats. One of them could speak Chinese and said he was a man from Great Shitian. He had sought a living Buddha in China and had traveled to the famous mountains of Putuo in Zhejiang province, to Wutai, to Emeshan in Sichuan, but did not find that there was a Buddha there. He learned that the Dalai Lama seemed to be one and went to see him, but learned that he was not. He also heard that in a foreign country, by which he means Mongolia, there was the Jebsun Damba Lama, who was a Buddha, and he trod the distant wastes to go and see him, but he also proved not to be one." So this is, I think, a very interesting account for several reasons. First of all, it really shows that, at least in their own self-description of their motives for coming to China and Mongolia, pilgrimage is the major goal. They want to go to the Chinese famous sacred peaks, and they want to see the leading Tibetan Buddhist figures. At least that's what they're claiming to this high-ranking official at that time. And so the other interesting thing is this is the only Chinese account of a Indian mendicant specifically in Mongolia. Most of the other references to these men are in other languages, and I think this is proof that the same people are going to both Mongolia and to China, and he uses the familiar vocabulary of Arhat and Great Western Heaven to describe those in Mongolia, just as those terms are used to describe the people who are in China at the same time. There's also, and I don't have a slide on it, I think, unfortunately, but there's very interesting evidence specifically about this figure, the Jebsum Damba Hutuktu, or Jebsum Dama Lama here, who is sort of the highest ranking Tibetan Buddhist cleric in northern Outer Mongolia, Halk Mongolia. He's born in 1635, in Mongolian accounts, in many of these Mongolian accounts have very explicitly kind of legendary religious overtones suggest that when he was born, an Indian mendicant mysteriously appeared and then disappeared quickly thereafter. There's another Mongolian language account that says that later in his life he was visited by two Indian mendicants who came to him asking the way to a place called Shambhala, a sort of mythical Buddhist kingdom in the north, and one of these two men foolishly didn't listen to him and ended up dying, but the other one listened to him and took him as a teacher and spent the rest of his life as an Indian living in the retinue of this Jebsum Damba Hutuktu. And I think while every individual Mongolian account you could argue has legendary aspects to it that maybe we can't take entirely at face value, I think there is pretty clear evidence that a number of Tibetan Buddhist, Indian mendicants are making their way to northern Mongolia to see this figure for reasons we could talk about. And for those not inclined to listen to Mongolian or Chinese evidence, we have the account of the Scottish traveler John Bell, who travels through Selangansk on his way from Russia to China as part of a diplomatic mission in 1720, and he says, "Lo and behold, there I was in the northernmost part of Mongolia, and I see this man, he's buying fish from children who are fishing and then setting the fish back in the river, and I perceive by his dress and the streak of saffron on his forehead that he was one of the Brahmins from India. He seemed much pleased, he could learn a bit of Russian, spoke some Portuguese, talked about his travels, said that he had been to Madras, to Chennai, that it belonged to the English, and he said he came to this country in company with some others of his countrymen on a pilgrimage in order to pay their devotions to the Jebsum Damba Hutuktu and the Dalai Lama, and he talks about the hardship of his journey." So I think there's very clear evidence that for whatever reason, a number of Indian mendicants are traveling on the major pilgrimage circuits of the Tibetan Buddhist world, going to see the Panchen Lama, Dalai Lama, and continuing on into Mongolia, where they're encountered by Scotsmen, Chinese, and Mongols. Let's see here. There's also a great deal of evidence about the Kham region, in particular, Dajian Lu, the sort of major trading mart on the border between Sichuan and Tibet. And there's a very interesting case that I don't have up here in the slides, but essentially a group of men who are described as arhats come to be arrested as far away as Guangdong province, just to the north of Canton. The Qing take these men into custody, interrogate them about their career, and learn that these men had come from India into Sichuan province, had settled down, one of them had gotten married in Sichuan province, and they had started trading between Sichuan and the port city of Canton, and had in fact made four very lucrative trading journeys between these two Chinese cities before they were arrested by the Qing government. And one of the trading goods that these men were carrying was coral, and I think there's also evidence that from a trading point of view, one of the commodities that they were probably taking was coral coming from the Mediterranean being sold at Madras, at Chennai, and then carried into Tibet for sale to Tibetan Buddhists and apparently also into China. And right around the same time, an official who had served in Western Sichuan in the 1740s during the Jinshan Wars, Chen Kesheng, says that he describes a place called Small Xitian, further west, there's a place called Great Xitian. It talks about sailing there. They reverence the Buddha. Famous monks are called Arhats. And there are those who come to Dajianlu to trade in corals and pearls. And so here again, and he says at the end that he personally inquired of these men, and this is what they said. So I think, again, that could be taken as evidence that he's speaking to them in Chinese and writing down what they're telling him would be my interpretation of this particular passage. There are a few other cases that I'll just quickly go through to give you a flavor of them. The last one I found also comes from a criminal case. A governor general in northern China sort of arrests a person on the road between probably Wu Taishan and Beijing and reports to the Qianlong emperor with the description of this suspicious character whom he's arrested. And the edict of the Qianlong emperor writes back and says, you know, based on what you're describing here, this is someone known as an Acharya Lama, that is to say a mendicant monk from Greater India. There are several of these lamas currently in Beijing, resident in the Shuanglin Temple. Because the said governor general did not understand his words or writing, he did not know his origins. And now this man has been sent to Beijing to the Lifan Yuan government agency, who will sort out his situation. So I think this is clear evidence as well that the Qianlong emperor is certainly familiar with this type of Indian mendicant coming to Beijing, living there in temples. And the fact that Qianlong here is using the term Acharya Lama, which is used in Tibetan and Mongolian for these men, rather than the more common Chinese words, I think suggests that the Qianlong emperor's own contact with these men or knowledge of these men is being mediated through a Tibetan Buddhist environment, which is probably what we would expect. And I think, again, for those maybe inclined to discount the significance of this Qing evidence, there's also a letter from the French Jesuit Antoine Gobile much earlier in 1725 who writes back to France and saying that there's a temple that houses, quote, idolatrous Indian priests, end quote, in Beijing. And I think that's probably the same temple being referred to, this Shuanglin Temple. And there's other evidence to that effect. So I don't want to go on too long, so let me sort of get into my conclusion and try to give you at least my preliminary conclusions about this phenomenon. I think there are a lot of unanswered questions about who these people were, but I think, first of all, there's evidence that this is a type of person that was widely recognized by Chinese scholars, certainly at least if you look at all the cases from Chinese sources. At least 80% of these Chinese sources describing these men, admittedly a relatively small sample size of 10, but 8 of the 10 use the term Great Xitian to describe these men. And these are sources written over 2 centuries in different parts of China. So I think there was a concept among Chinese observers at that time that there was a type of person coming from Great Xitian who could be described as an arhat. As I argued, I think the idea that these men are arhats is to some extent a Chinese projection onto them based on the Chinese understanding of who an arhat is. But at the same time, I think we should also take into account the fact that many of these men were described as themselves speaking Chinese, able to talk themselves about where they were coming from. And presumably, for whatever reason, these men themselves were choosing to use this vocabulary to describe where they were coming from. And I wonder if there might not be a Xuanzang tie-in here, because in the novel, The Journey to the West, which of course becomes very popular right around this time, the term Western Heaven and Great Western Heaven is used for India. So maybe there's some element of that seeping into these accounts as well, although no one explicitly refers to this novel. So I think another point that's worth making is there are certain geographic hotspots or nodes of activity that recur in many of these accounts. First of all, Kham is repeatedly mentioned in a number of cases, so it's clear that a lot of people were traveling from Lhasa through Kham to Sichuan, and there are also a lot of references to Beijing. Beijing seems to be the point where many of these men were going to, whether they came from the northern route or from the southern route. And obviously, one of the things that they would be finding in Beijing was imperial patronage, both under the Ming and later, presumably, also under the Qing, at least in the Qianlong period. So it's not too hard to understand why Beijing might be their goal for at least part of the time. I think clearly, from the Chinese point of view, whatever these men were actually doing in China, whether they came for commerce or not, from the Chinese point of view, they were there as Buddhists. They had come on pilgrimage. They wanted to visit holy sites in China, specifically mountains, and they also wanted to visit, as I've said, the sort of major sites of the major Tibetan Buddhist clerics of that time. And so certainly from the Chinese point of view, this is a remnant Buddhist phenomena. Nobody in these accounts ever says these men are Hindu or they're not Buddhist. And so this raises, I think, the very complicated question that I can't get into here and don't really have the expertise to get into of, from the Chinese point of view, is there such a thing as Hinduism in this period? Is there a perceived distinction between Buddhism and Hinduism, or is this one religious continuum? And if you meet an Indian mendicant, you would perceive him as being some kind of Buddhist, maybe a slightly different type of Buddhist than you. Another interesting thing is that almost all of these men are somehow connected to temples, and so one of the questions you would ask that I don't have the answer to is, are they receiving patronage from these temples for free? Are they paying their own way? If they're paying their own way, then certainly we have to assume that they're conducting business on the side to have some sort of income, or are they relying entirely on charity in their travels? And maybe that's one of the things drawing them to the Qing Empire, is the availability of charity. If so, who is this coming from? Is it coming from only the Tibetan Buddhist side, also the Chinese Buddhist side? If you're an Indian mendicant, can you just show up at a Chinese Buddhist temple and expect people to give you a place to stay and some food or not? That's an interesting question that I can't answer. I think one of the other questions that we can raise but maybe not conclusively answer at this point is the question of the rise and decline of this phenomena. As far as I can tell, the emergence of Indian mendicants in China being described specifically as coming from Great Western Heaven or being arhats is something that begins to emerge at the very end of the 1500s, start of the 1600s, at the earliest. Of course, Indian mendicants had been coming to China for a very long time, especially Buddhists. There's a long record of that. But whether we should understand this as a sort of new phenomena of the late 16th century, early 17th century, or whether we should connect it as a continuation of earlier Indian travel into China overland for religious purposes, I think that's very much an open question. If this is a new phenomena rather than a continuation of earlier Buddhist mendicant travel from India, then we would have to raise the question of what exactly is new in the late 16th century that starts this ball rolling, and we could speculate that there's an increasing commercialization in the Himalayas, an increase in trade between Tibet and India in this period that gets increased traffic across the Himalayas. There's some evidence to that effect, but whether this is really the primary cause or not of what's going on is hard to say. There's also the question of the decline of this phenomena. So far, having looked pretty thoroughly, at least as far as I'm able to, I haven't found any cases of this after 1800. The last case is from the 1780s. And so obviously, the recording of these Indian mendicants in China is totally accidental. They run into some Chinese literati or official who says, this is a very interesting person that I've met. I'm going to note it down in my jotting book, and that's how most of these records come down to us. So one question that raises is, what percent of Indian mendicants going into China, into the Qing Empire, end up getting recorded? Do we have records of 1% of the total, 50% of the total? Very hard to determine the exact number of people who are following this route. And also, of course, the fact that nobody's writing down records about them doesn't necessarily mean that they're no longer traveling, but I think the fact that there are no records of this type after 1800 is very suggestive that, in fact, Indian mendicants who were going pretty regularly in the 17th, 18th century, for some reason around 1800, stop doing this. And maybe this is one of the reasons why this phenomena was not well understood by scholars in the 19th century and 20th century. So if we accept that something changes around 1800, we can speculate quite a bit about what reasons might have caused it. And I think there are many potential reasons, each of which has a certain plausibility, but also some objections could be raised. So for example, the East India Company launches a campaign in the late 1700s, against specifically armed Gosains in Bengal, who they see as a menace to society that they want to get rid of. So it's possible that this campaign in the 1770s diminishes the feasibility of Gosain travel into Tibet and onward, but I think that doesn't seem to be the case based on Turner's records, and I would sort of suggest that's probably not what's going on. There's the much ballyhooed closing, quote-unquote, of Tibet after the Qing-Gurkha War in the 1790s. Certainly in the 1790s, the Qing moved to increase border controls in Tibet, keep a closer eye on who was coming into the empire, but at the same time, there's a lot of evidence that Nawari traders from Nepal, Kashmiri traders from India were still going into Tibet relatively unhindered in relatively large numbers. So I think the idea that Tibet became closed in the 1790s has to be taken with a bit of a grain of salt, especially for these obviously religious travelers like these mendicants. Of course, the Qing Empire goes into a sort of a downward spiral in the 1790s in particular, during the Chenlong-Jiaqing imperial transition. So certainly there's a reason why the Qing Empire might become less hospitable to an Indian mendicant traveler around the 1790s, but I think, again, we have to take that with a grain of salt, because these travelers were traveling through great political upheaval in earlier centuries, and so why upheaval in the 1790s, early 1800s would have a much greater impact than earlier upheavals is an open question. Certainly, there's less official patronage of Tibetan Buddhism after the death of the Chenlong Emperor in 1799. The amount of money flowing into the Tibetan Buddhist world from Beijing goes down. That may have made it less attractive to travel in those circuits. But again, these men were clearly going to China long before the Qing emperors were giving major patronage to the Tibetan Buddhist church. So why the drop-off in that patronage should prevent their travel is hard to say. And finally, I'll note the question of the upsurge in private trade, private maritime trade between China and India from the 1760s onward. I think that may be ultimately what's going on. If these men who are seen by Chinese observers as being primarily religious pilgrims are in fact trading or funding themselves by trade, it's quite possible that something in the trading algorithm of the time started to shift with the flow of maritime trade to Canton from India in larger amounts, and maybe their business model in ways that we don't fully understand was no longer viable after 1800. So those are all questions that I don't have answers to, a mysterious phenomena, but one I think we can learn something from. So thank you.